All right, so how many people here are in undergrad? Okay, nobody, one person. Okay, master's? Okay, PhD? Okay, all physics? Put up your hand if you're not doing physics. Not to ostracize anybody that's not doing physics. So what I'm gonna just talk to you about is a little bit about my journey and how, you know, it really started with this love of building things, and it kind of turned into, you know, what sounds like a very, you know, business-oriented story today. But hopefully, it'll give you a perspective on some important decisions that I made along the way, and how, you know, physics and the love of, you know, solving problems and especially solving really hard problems has been invaluable for me. So I've always been pretty good at building things. I was a kid. That loved, you know, solving puzzles. I was the kid that was really excited about, you know, answering his mom or dad's math questions. I have three little girls today, so I have one of those among the three. Is you know, she was like what I was like, saying, you know, always trying to get the answer, mostly guessing and usually getting it wrong, but having you know, no problem going and trying to answer again. So I started young, and I was really into, you know, radios and, you know, just building things. And I got into sports. I was you know, I was an athlete in soccer and football and basketball, you name it, tennis. I kind of did everything. And then one of my coaches, our soccer coach, actually the two soccer coaches at my grade school and then later at high school were actually the physics and science teachers of the school, and, you know, suggested that I get involved in something called science fair, which, you know, I thought would get me extremely, you know, ridiculed and mocked by all my sports friends, but I was really interested in it, and so I did it, and one thing led to another, and I had this experience where, you know, in a very short period of time, designing what you see on the screen, basically a wing that actually does something, you know, provides the right amount of down pressure in this kind of car, a Porsche, at the right times, I realized that, wow, I could actually do something. I could get connected with people in industry, and it could become real from just an idea, and I could actually, you know, win something, and winning feels good in sports or other things, and I could also make a bit of money. And having grown up not too far from here in Hamilton, my parents were immigrants from Greece. I was an only child, you know, very humble beginnings. The idea of, you know, winning a bit of money and being recognized and, you know, being good at something seemed pretty attractive. So I kind of stuck with it, and then one thing led to another. There was a physicist and a group at McMaster University that was in this sort of cutting edge of work in the space of superconductors. So when Joseph was talking about Cooper pairs and, you know, their behavior in superconducting materials, there's a real connection, because that's really, if I can sort of point to one thing that was kind of a breakout move for me, was, you know, just discovering this article, which was literally a Scientific American article, and then calling the department, and I was 15 when that happened, and saying, hey, I'd really like to come and, you know, do an internship or learn about these superconductors. These were, type 2 yttrium barium copper oxide superconductors, and, you know, what can we do with them? The materials were pretty brittle, they're ceramics, hard to make them into anything, but could we make them into a form of superconducting magnet? Could we leverage the Meissner effect and, you know, create frictionless bearings? One thing led to another, and all of a sudden we had a superconducting-based motor, or effectively a motor that could be used in a turbo pump in the main booster rocket of the shuttle program. And, you know, that initial call to a couple of guys at McMaster University led to access to a lab, NASA funding, and winning this overall, I jokingly call it the Nerd Olympics, but it's something run by the US Defense Department called the International Science and Engineering Fair. Kids from about 80 countries, usually about two or three per country, with the exception of the US that sends, like, you know, a few hundred. And the year that I won it all, Andy Grove, a Hungarian immigrant to the US, later became the CEO of Intel, decided to fund this program for the next, I don't know, the next 50 years or something like that. And it was a great example of, again, just a random exposure, you know, serendipity, and going after an opportunity. Ended up building something that obviously required, you know, some physics, but a lot of engineering and a lot of just, you know, chutzpah to try and figure it out and go find people to help me. You know, and it led to scholarships and it led to funding for, actually, in those years, you could do a grade 13 year in high school. I was done my courses through the end of grade 12, but I actually stayed for that extra year, and all I did that year was play sports and work for NASA and have a whole lab set up at McMaster University. And I honestly, to this day, I think I learned more doing that than I did through my entire undergrad, where we got to talking about Cooper pairs in fourth year and got to talking about, you know, some of the behaviors of these advanced materials quite late. So anyways, for me, this is actually a great experience, not only because of the science and the engineering and like being resourceful and figuring stuff out, but it was also a great experience because all of a sudden you had to talk about it and convince someone that you knew what you were talking about and convince someone that, in fact, what you had was innovative and novel and could really help people or solve, you know, solve problems that were important in the world. And sometimes it's not enough. It's actually most of the time not enough to actually create something that solves a problem. You actually have to be able to tell people about it and convince people that your approach is the one that they should choose. So that was my exposure to engineering and engineering, you know, in the area of you know, physics or solving problems that, you know, a physicist would want to solve and eventually potentially turn into a product. And I thought, you know, I had no one in my family that was an engineer or a physicist. And, you know, what do you do? I had all these scholarships and opportunities. But I honestly was kind of tired of the working, because it was a lot of work as well. And of my tours of universities, I ended up choosing Queens over Princeton, MIT, and a couple other schools, partly because it was close, and partly because the tour of the school was the most fun. It ended with, you know, an invitation to a party that night, which was, you know, way more fun than what I got at Princeton. So the Princeton tour is very boring. Anyways, so I went on to study EngPhys at Queens, and during that time, yeah, so this Sterling Hall was my home for, you know, most of the time that I was there. It's the physics department. There was a guy by the name of Art McDonald that was in the department, and he was building this crazy detector underground in a, you know, abandoned mine, or maybe it's not abandoned, I think it was still functioning, in Sudbury. And as like part of your penance as a student in first and second year, you had to like work in the basement of Sterling Hall to build one of these, to build some aspect of the detector. So I was doing like these photovoltaic cells. And so I did it, and you know, the irony is that many, or not irony, but coincidence is many years later, you know, that thing, the giant thing, who knows the story of the snow detector? Some of you. Okay, so the thing actually worked, solved a very important problem, which led to a Nobel Prize, and Art also serves on the board here at Perimeter. But anyways, you know, that was where I spent a lot of time, and this whole thing about, you know, getting good at not only solving a hard problem, but explaining it, you know, landed me a job at Microsoft. And this was just like one of those summer internships, but it was with Microsoft Research. And unlike, you know, parts of Microsoft where my friends were going to go work to, you know, code part of Microsoft Word or you know, a spreadsheet, Excel, I got to work on just whatever hard problem I wanted to solve. And so one of the problems that was interesting at the time was is known as the traveling salesman problem, or a version of the traveling salesman problem, right? You've got to go from city A to city F, and maybe make a drop-off at city D along the way. What's the best route? So finding that optimal route when the number of nodes on the network is beyond a certain number is actually a problem that is hard or impossible to solve. Imagine having billions of nodes on the network in the future, and so this is like 1992, so that future is now. Billions of nodes on the network and mobile devices, and the idea of sending video on the network was zero latency. That was the problem that Bill Gates and Nathan Merivold, who was the CTO of Microsoft at the time, also a physicist, that was a problem they wanted to solve. Because the network routers of the day, the way that they decided when how a packet should go from point A to point B was through a lookup in literally a database on board into a routing table, right? You need to go from point A to B, take this path. And so the theory was, well, that's just not going to be good enough when you have video on the network. And so I invented a way to do it, leveraging some of the tech from the superconductor work, genetic algorithms, genetic programs, basically software that kind of writes itself, and solve this this problem of routing packets on a very large future internet to support video. And so some of this technology is in the current TCP/IP, I think V6 stack, but that's, you know, how I got into, you know, from the world of physics and rockets to software was doing this work at Microsoft. And all of a sudden, this is probably the peak of my physics, my grad school project, which combined with the Microsoft work kind of landed me the job in Silicon Valley. And that was the beginning of the internet. Banking was one of the applications that people used a lot. And if you banked, you wanted to see a little key. I don't know if the browsers still do that. I think they'd show the lock up in the browser address bar. But it used to be a little lock, and that lock was something you wanted to see to know that your transactions were secure. Those cryptographic keys were generated on the local PC using a really dumb approach, which if you look at Shannon's law, the amount of information or amount of surprise in those keys was really, really small and very easy to hack. So it created a way to do it basically using a quantum system that used a radioactive material. So anyways, that combined with the Microsoft work, and I get a call to go to California. And I had like the full-time job at Microsoft, and they were going to sponsor further grad work for me in engineering, and especially in that area of the cryptographic key work. But this job kind of looked interesting, except for the fact that it was $0 of salary. It was living on in someone's apartment with people I didn't know, sleeping on a couch. And the other offer was $100,000, which in 1996 was still a lot of money. Back then it was a lot of money, and certainly my parents thought it was absolutely nuts when I took the California option instead. You know, they were like, "What? Where did we go wrong? Why are you doing this to us? Why are you taking, you know, this? You're not going to get paid." But I went because I got a call from this guy and his brother. And I think everybody knows who this picture is today. Back then, I don't think anybody knew. But Elon Musk and his brother Kimball were also at Queen's University around the same time that I was. Kimball was a year ahead of me. Elon was 3 years ahead of me and had left to go to Penn to finish his business degree there before I got to meet him. Anyways, they wanted to build something that enabled people to find businesses on the internet. So I moved down there, you know, with Microsoft experience and, you know, cryptographic key, you know, software experience and base internet stack, you know, knowledge. And at the time, you have to understand, like, there's very few people that knew those three things. And so if you wanted to build a mass scale internet service, like, there wasn't tools that you could just download and do it. You kind of had to make them. I didn't do that by design. I just kind of had it. And then when I got this opportunity, I went mostly because one of my mentors at the time said, "You know what, go to California, it'll be fine, it'll be warmer and not rainy like Seattle. And if it doesn't work out, you can come back." So, you know, a lot of serendipity, and I just kind of took the option and helped build this service with another Canadian guy who is actually exec at Microsoft these days, a Russian guy named Darko that, I don't know what happened to Darko, but he was a lot of fun. And a creative guy, you'll love this, creative guy, San Francisco, super creative, flamboyant guy named Simon Boy Genius. His actual middle name was Boy, and he changed his last name to Genius. So So anyways, we built this business in a restaurant, literally a blown out. It was like, there was a fire there, a restaurant on California Street in Palo Alto, kind of the core of Silicon Valley. It was not like the TV show, although definitely a comedy of errors at times. And for me, it was how I got the bug to want to build companies. Because I saw, wait a minute, you know, I get buildings, you know, doing basic research, I get the building of tech, I get the building of product, but what seems like a more complex problem and one that leveraged, you know, the things that I was really good at and I was interested in was the idea of building companies. So that company was called Zip2. It sold for $300 million several years later to Alta Vista, which was kind of the first Google before there was Google. And for me, it was my example that this building a company thing is something I'm interested in, and I think I could do it. So I started this company. It was a company that had the idea that, hey, in the future, we will all send documents or files or information through the internet, and we'll probably actually store most of it on the internet, you know, in the cloud. And back then, we would draw these, you know, we'd have these slide pictures that showed, you know, the cloud in the middle and like person A and person B and a storage database in the cloud. Anyways, nobody knew what we were talking about, but we were the first big example of that. So identical, if you use Google Drive today or Dropbox or Box, we were the first version of that. We grew tremendously fast and basically became the 800-pound gorilla of the space. And 7 days before the market peaked in the year 2000, we sold it. And so sometimes it's absolutely a lot better to be lucky than good. And this was one of those times where, you know, we had built something, we were great, we were like, we'd figured it out, we got to what's called product market fit, and we were really scaling. But if we had sold like 6 days later, or tried to sell the company, or maybe we didn't sell the company and we're still trying to build it, we would have been toast. So I kind of parlayed that experience to basically taking over, ultimately, the company that bought us. Because back to this picture, things went bad for everybody in the space at the time. It was a very depressing and sad time. You know, I'll talk about the pit of despair later. Anyways, I decided to stick it out, which was a weird, you know, I always look back on this decision. I play the, you know, the movie over and over again. You know, what would have been different if I just decided to go start something new? Because right around that time, companies like Facebook and Google were just getting going. And people that I knew that had sold their company during the peak, you know, they were kind of hunkered down working on their next project, or, you know, one guy went surfing in Costa Rica for a while. I, on the other hand, stuck through what was like nuclear winter for the next 4 years to rebuild this company. You know, I was raising $5 million of venture capital before. All of a sudden, I was raising $500 million of, you know, public and private money. I was busy selling services in the U.S., in Canada. All of a sudden, I was traveling to 70, 80 countries a year. I was busy hiring a ton of people. I was busy restructuring and like shutting down offices and consolidating and getting more efficient. I was busy talking to like my board, which included my best friend and, you know, some other, you know, other local people. All of a sudden, I was on analyst calls and doing analyst days. So for me, this was like a big growing up, kind of the MBA without having actually to go sit in a classroom. And it just made me think, wow, you know, I can not only start something, but I can scale something. I can change and fix something that's really screwed up. And that requires a lot of real, you know, a real determination, guts, brain power, you know, will, and, you know, I could feel like I can do anything. So what came next was unexpected. I met my now wife, who has Also Canadian, but had grown up in Saudi Arabia and then became an NCAA, you know, all-American swimmer, became a Wall Streeter, but was tired of Wall Street. I was kind of tired of Silicon Valley. A bunch of my friends were leaving. Elon Musk moved to LA, other friends moved back to the Midwest. So we decided to move back to Canada. And around that time, I started having this set of conversations. We had our first daughter on the way. And the what should I do next conversation was kind of the topic of many coffees and dinners and lunches. And I met a woman, famous, popular entrepreneur in Canada, Heather Reisman, over a lunch, and she shared this thing that had been really driving her, her thoughts around what happens to this business of books as more and more content goes digital. The music business was kind of decimated, refactored, and most of the players who were there before, were not there after. Movies looked like it was going to get Netflixed, even though it was still early days. What happens to the world of books? And my experience was, if you have an idea and you have the will, and you can create better economics or better usability or open something to more people, transformation was probably inevitable. And so my answer was, I think you're screwed. I think this business is going to dramatically change, and there will be a pure play, right? A Netflix of the category. There will likely be some of the existing kind of internet or tech juggernauts that get into it, because this is just another content category, and why wouldn't they want to be in it? And we went on to create a company called Kobo. You might have heard of it, although these days I think most people download ebooks to their phones through Apple or Google or some of the dominant platforms. Kobo was a business that grew from zero to $1 billion of sales in about 5 years. And I mean, I'd done different kinds of companies before that I shared, but that kind of growth from zero on a business that started as an idea on a napkin at a lunch in downtown Toronto, I hadn't done. And this is a business where, at the start, Jeff Bezos, the Amazon CEO, was saying, no one's gonna ever read a book, because a book is different, and a book is special. No one's gonna ever read a book on a mobile phone or a mobile device. But they will read a book on this new Amazon Kindle special device. And I said to investors, as I raised about 20 million bucks to create this company, he's wrong. Everyone's gonna read on the device that they already have, and it'll just be ubiquitous. I'll go from watching my latest House of Cards episode on Netflix to listening to a song on Spotify to reading a book on Kobo. It'll just be an app, and content, like prices would likely go down, and this would likely be one of two or three global brands, and there's an opportunity to build it if we start now. So we did, and the moment we fundraised and we started the company and we got going, first board meeting happened, and I said to everybody, we are gonna build one of those awesome e-reading devices anyway. And the board was like, what? You just said we don't need to do that. I'm like, we absolutely need to do it, and we're gonna do it in the next 4 months. And so myself and three other guys that I went to engineering physics school with at Queens, one guy from Stanford, basically did what most consumer electronics companies take about 18 to up to 36 months to get a device from idea to shelf. We did it in 5 months and got the first Kobo readers on the shelves for Mother's Day in Canada, and then soon after, and that's a whole other set of stories, about 80 countries, and all of a sudden the business skyrocketed and people used us on our e-readers, on our mobile devices. We became number one or number two in every country, within about 3 to 6 months of entering that country. And we had a model that, like Intel in the days that Intel was a bigger brand, we were the Kobo inside or Intel inside of every national bookseller on the planet. We were doing business ultimately in over 190 countries. So eventually we sold that to a Japanese internet company, and I was kind of in that position again of what do? Software is eating up the world. This is a famous Mark Andreessen line, another guy that was just a few years ahead of me when I first moved to the Valley. And there's absolutely, once you've done this a few times, there's absolutely a pattern, and a pattern that, you know, you can try to replicate, and that I started trying to replicate in investments in startup companies that I've made, but also in my next company, which really is in the space of healthcare. And that company's called League. We started out with this idea that healthcare would just be very different in the future. And this really came out of not 20 years of healthcare experience. This just came out of my personal experience accessing healthcare, living in California or living back in Ontario. My experience as an employer offering health insurance as a part of benefits to employees in California, or actually with those companies all over the US and all over the world. Generally the experience sucks, and you pay for something that, you know, it doesn't seem to add up, it doesn't seem to follow typical economics. So the idea that this would be likely transformed, and it would be transformed by consumers having power in their hands on a mobile device or through some cloud service, was one that I kind of fell in love with, and we got going. Very quickly we learned that, wait a minute, most people access healthcare through insurance. Maybe we should kind of, that should be somehow a part of the story, but those companies in that business are like 100, 150 years old, right? Manulife, the Manufacturers Life Insurance Company of Canada. Go down the list, they're all over 100 years. Like, how could we possibly, you know, be disruptive to companies like that? So we dug in, and I won't read all the words here. The pattern in this category is very simple. It gets more expensive every year, you get less, and it sucks. Literally, it sucks. That score on the right side is something called NPS. It's a measure of customer satisfaction. Prisoners in America value prisons and their prison experience more than humans, than all of us, value health insurance. Right? It's actually 12. The numbers, if you're a prisoner on the East Coast of the US, you actually give your prisons a higher score than people give their health insurance. So that seemed like, you know, a problem screaming to be solved. And so that's what League is trying to do, is trying to reimagine that health insurance experience. And you know, I'm a few years into it, and you know, it's, I'll talk about the pit of despair. You know, it's a very hard problem. So in my spare time, I spend time here at PI, CDL, Mars, Vector. Basically, all of these are supporting people who are like me, or, you know, wanted to solve problems, whether, you know, in basic science and physics, in machine learning or AI, starting a company from scratch at Creative Destruction Lab, or in the space of health at Mars. And I guess I'll close out with some lessons learned along the way that maybe you can apply in your careers and what you do next. The first, Richard, and this is Richard Feynman, unless you don't know him, my favorite physicist besides Art MacDonald. Turns out that it's a pretty awesome basis. Physics is a pretty awesome basis for solving all kinds of problems in business. You know, the Black-Scholes example that Joseph gave, I regularly see, you know, BS option pricing, which sometimes I think is a different BS. But anyways, Black-Scholes option pricing is something you see all the time. But beyond that, you know, creating a business model, solving a very complex, multivariate, multidimensional type problem as you're forming the business. Everyone always sees one of these businesses when it's already formed, and you're like, oh, that looks obvious. They just built this, you know, amazing set of, you know, fiber optic equipment to, you know, to enable the future of the internet. Well, it wasn't always that simple, right? There was a lot of trial and error and figuring stuff out. And the same goes in every one of the stories that I've told you. Most of the time, it felt very scary, desperate, and like unlikely to turn into a success. And I regularly say that as a CEO of a startup or as a tech company, you know, it's like out of every 100 days, there's like 99 punches in the face, and one day like where you get like you get on stage and you get to share your glory. But in the middle of all that, you have to be solving hard problems all the time, and I regularly see it among new recruits that you know, that work on my team, that people that have, you know, a background in physics and engineering, they just kind of go to first principles. versus go to fear or go to confusion or go to, like, I don't know what the hell to do here. They go to first principles and they solve problems that way. And I find, especially when you're creating something out of nothing in a new category, starting from first principles and having that kind of approach is very effective. Second point, Wayne Gretzky, my favorite hockey player slash hero. I wish I was getting an honorary degree with him somewhere. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So I hope you heard that in every one of the examples I gave you, I'm not a healthcare person. Maybe I am now, but I wasn't when I started. I certainly wasn't a telecom, you know, messaging, communications expert before I took over this company running, you know, a third to half of the global email and text messaging. I was not a publishing or book expert. I just decided to take a shot. And, you know, in most of these cases, it wasn't that the odds looked good. The odds looked kind of terrible. Think about it in the Kobo example, going up against Amazon, right? When we were number one, they were number two. When they were number one, we were number two. Jeff Bezos has a lot more money in his balance sheet, a brand that everybody knows, distribution and the willingness to lose money for decades. I had none of that. So it wasn't that the odds were good. It was just, hey, it looks like this is going to happen, so why not me? So take some shots. Entrepreneurship, like my early days in EngFizz, it's a team sport. My second term of EngFizz, we had 10 classes, and I think on top of that, I had some labs. And then the same thing in the sort of the next term, and third year was also a bit tough. You couldn't do that all on your own. I don't know, maybe you guys can, but I could not. And so it was a team sport, and we really, to survive and to do well, to thrive, you really had to learn how to work with others. Starting companies and building businesses and solving hard problems, it's the same. And so that team dynamic and working in that team dynamic, whether it's in a lab or, you know, department or in a large company or small company, is pretty important. I've been lucky that along the way, I've picked up some people that are some of my best friends, and we just continue to work together on the next company. The guy on the left, leftmost in this picture, Dan, I met him through a classified ad, yes, that used to be a thing, and when I needed to find someone to help me with DocSpace, and we've built every company that I've mentioned today together and still work together to this day. And this picture is actually just at the base of the Acropolis in Athens when we were deciding to start League about 3.5 years ago. Building anything is almost always like the Olympics. It's global. Certainly there's demonstration sports that might not be here next time. It's not guaranteed that whatever you build will be around. Joseph shared, brand names like Nortel, which was like a hot company for me to go to work for when I graduated, not around anymore. Ultimately, there's only two or three companies on the podium in the end, just like there's only two or three medalists. And it's rare that anybody remembers any one of those finalists other than number one or number two. So you have to kind of start with that end in mind. Think global, but you need to start where you are and start local, which is what I've had the experience of doing with each of these companies. There's almost always in disruption is incumbents that are 100 times the size of you, they've been around for 50 to 100 years, and that's okay. What you learn is that inside those companies, there are departments and divisions of departments and people that are doing a piece. Nobody has the whole picture, and it's just really hard to turn those ships versus as a David in this kind of proverbial David and Goliath story, that is the number one thing you do have, is to be able to move and adjust and be agile. And so as a regular occurrence in a startup, when the outside world thinks you are killing it, you are on top, in the inside, you're like, ah, I wish we could move faster. Why is this thing taking so long? This code is not ready. This customer's upset. And so when you have that kind of a high standard for agility, it's A, your secret weapon, but over time, as you scale, it becomes more constrained, but the Goliath almost never has it. So don't let that scare you. This is kind of, you've probably seen this, right? Success, everyone always thinks it's a straight line. It's actually less direct than that. Here's my version of that, having built a bunch of these companies. So here's the pit of despair, right? So the day you launch your first thing, whatever the thing is, right? Your first beta or your MVP or your thesis is like the most exciting day you're gonna experience, the most proud day and happy day you're gonna experience for a long time. Because the moment you come off the high, the only person that loves you in the pit of despair are your parents. Like, that's it, right? And you may never come out of that pit of despair, which is why the line disconnects off the, you may never make it. But if you kind of stick to it and continue being agile, I call it the path of enlightenment, where you finally see a light and it's not a train heading for you, and then you can kind of take off, which has been my experience building things. And so the last lesson is, it never sort of turns out how you think. Every single one of the companies, I save all the original kind of that. I actually have a few of the napkins, literally napkins, dirty with French fry ketchup, framed and on the wall at home. They almost never turn out how you think. But it's the journey that matters, and the journey can be epic if you know where you're headed. Be clear on the destination, be super flexible on the journey and who's on the journey with you to get to the end and whatever that promised land is for you. So that's it for me. I'll leave you with this one note, which is kind of why I spend most of my time when I'm not with my family and not with my company on things like perimeter and fundamental science, tech, innovation. I actually think, so we live in a great place. I'm super happy to be here and proud to be Canadian. I had the opportunity to not be here for a while, and I kind of had that experience, and I came back because this is a great place to live. But this is a place, coming back to some economics for a second, that kind of depends for the most part on an economy that requires us to take stuff out of the ground and sell it. And every time and those are all cyclical businesses. And every time that kind of slows down, the economy goes to hell in a handbasket for a while, and everything slows down. And it leads to an economic growth rate that is a lot less and is kind of falling behind kind of the leaders in the world. And I think our way out of that is really through innovation. And if you look at a lot of places like PI, like Vector, like the Milo Lab in Montreal, studying kind of quantum and AI and machine learning, we have some of the best people here on the planet in those categories. I can tell you, in my experience with Vector, we have sovereign governments that are wanting to write us $100 million to $1 billion checks to be connected to us. Why? Because the best people in the world are here in that space. Not every category, but we have a number of categories where that's the case. The KW region and University of Waterloo and CompSci and the co-op program and all the startups that have been built around here are a key part of that story. I mean, beyond Silicon Valley, the most dense place in the world for startup development is here. So I really think this is a huge opportunity for us for the next 20 years. I'm excited to be a part of it, and I hope you are too. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jesse.
I lost the slide. That last slide is my favorite. I actually don't know who to attribute it to. There it is. I find this kind of explains everything you need to know about building something out of nothing. I first heard this line actually connected to the movie Inception. Is it Leonardo DiCaprio? Anyways, so there are those who are dreamers and those who are stuck in reality, and then there are those that can turn one thing into another, which is ultimately what I think physicists do, what engineers do, and what entrepreneurs do building companies. So, I don't know, share that. I think it's good. All right, thanks.
We're trying to get a few questions in.
I can do questions, yeah.
I know we're kind of kind of into our coffee break, but I think we certainly should take the time to have a, we'll take two questions, and then of course we can have some more discussion over the coffee break. So if anyone has questions, we have a microphone here. Just come on up to it. And
you don't have to. Everybody wants coffee. What's the most difficult moment in my career? I feel like I'm going through it right now. So, not here. So here's how I would describe it, and I guess I've had it a few times, and it's a pattern. It's just a part of the process of building something, and it's that part. It's literally the bottom of the pit of despair where a lot of people just check out. So, you know, the stats on building companies is that, 95% of them don't see, like, past year one. And I don't know what the percentage is beyond that, but there's very few companies that make it, right? And that point at the bottom of the pit of despair, you know, no one's buying your product, you're spending too much money, you're running out of money, and you know, and then all sorts of other things. You start to notice, right? All sorts of other things go wrong in your life, right? You're getting, like, you're stressed, you're getting heavier, you're slower, you're not sleeping, and you have a choice. And the choice is to check out and say, this is not for me, or this is just not meant to be. Or you have a choice to just tell yourself that tomorrow will be different. And I actually think it's that simple. Right, it's that moment. And so I've faced that a bunch of times. My first time when I faced it, I had no idea. No one had ever told me, you know, the pattern. I had not been through it before. Today we talk about mental health as a real important topic, and we're more open about it. But 20 years ago, we were not. And I mean, I was like near breakdown in that moment. I'd say the second time was a bit easier, the third time. And usually it happens when there are other signals in the world that, you know, things actually are better. You just don't, you know, you're kind of focusing on the ones that are not good. And so it kind of forces you, once you've learned the pattern, just to be one of those people. If you're gonna choose this as a vocation to be building something, whether it's a company or division or, you know, a product or like mission to Mars, you know, that just sees all the positive. You cannot look at, like, I flew to Columbus, Ohio yesterday for the day. Don't ask me why. Flew back, and a guy that was with me, younger guy, also Queens engineering guy, that's doing some work with us, says, you know, how do you think things are going? And, you know, he highlighted a bunch of things that were not working. I'm like, listen, these other three things are tremendous and are amazing. And I just heard from these, you know, five other people, the CEOs of X, Y, and Z company, that, you know, League is the bomb. And, you know, we don't have to worry about these other three things you've listed, honestly, just the wrong things to focus on. So I think it's that moment, to answer your question in short, it's that moment where you could give up or go on when you're at the bottom of the pit of despair. And the choice for me has been just to go on every time. And I think the way to get through that is just by your lens on the world. Focus on the positive. You're welcome.
Okay, shoot. It's said a lot of times in business that making your first million, I guess, is the hardest. And you sort of touched on that, maybe a little bit, it gets easier the second time you go through this process. And you worked, you started a Zip2 company with Elon Musk, you worked for zero salary and slept on a couch. Is there, looking back, would there have been an easier way to do that? And you just talked about how you had a lot of emotional issues at the time as well. Looking back, would there have been an easier way to do that?
To what?
Just start that initial company, I guess. The first company there where you...
Yeah. So I actually think today that a process, there's a lot of places in the world that are trying to codify that process of building a company. And so you've probably heard the term of incubators or accelerators. There's programs like, one of the best ones is Creative Destruction Lab. Communitech is a place here in KW that really focuses on that. And for me, like one of the luckiest things that happened that kind of made it possible to make it through the other side was I found someone that could help, a mentor. Someone that, you know, when I was at the bottom, at the pit of despair, or, you know, at another crucial moment, just could give a different perspective versus the perspective that I was kind of creating. So places like CDL and Communitech, and there's a whole bunch of others now, I mean, that's what Y Combinator tries to do. They surround you with, you know, mentors, a process. They're almost trying to mass produce or manufacture these companies. Now, that said, I've funded a bunch of companies that have gone through those programs. I don't think it makes, I guess it removes the question marks that are easy to remove, right? Like, this is how you do this thing and that thing, you know, like open a bank account, get a lawyer, get like all that stuff. It makes that stuff, the mechanical stuff, easier, but the, how do you navigate to create this new business or new company or give this new technology, you know, purpose? It doesn't solve that for you. It maybe can nudge you along the way a little bit, but I still think that's left to the people, right? The founding team, and that's, I do believe in that sort of concept that it is a team sport, because I think it's just really hard for one person to do it on their own. And I actually don't know of any examples personally, of great companies where it purely was one person with no other help. You know, there's usually a co-founder, may not always see her or see him, because one person kind of takes the mantle or the podium, but there's always more people involved. So, I don't know, I think those programs are, they make it a lot easier today, but there's still stuff that you have to figure out on your own, and I do think mentors really help. You're welcome.
So let's thank all of our speakers, and we'll have a coffee break right outside here, and then we'll reconvene probably in about 20 minutes.